Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another podcast. I'm Christina Vogt, Assistant Editor for Consultant360.com. I'm speaking with board-certified nurse practitioner Lucia Novak, Director of the Riverside Diabetes Center and Adjunct Assistant Professor in the Graduate School of Nursing at Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences in Maryland. This podcast series is centered around clinical inertia and the role of long-acting insulin therapy in the physiologic approach to diabetes management. What is clinical inertia and how common is it in treating type 2 diabetes?
Clinical inertia has existed for a really long time, and we tend to define it as a failure to both establish appropriate targets and then to escalate or intensify treatment in order to achieve whatever treatment goals you may have set for a patient. It accounts for many, at least 200,000 is where I think I've seen in some reports, diabetes-related complications a year, all of which are typically preventable complications. And clinical inertia also contributes to the direct and indirect healthcare costs that are skyrocketing, especially here in the United States. As for your second part of that question, as how common is it when we're treating patients with diabetes, Drs. Steve Edelman and Will Polonsky back in 2017 have a report out that looked at just this factor of clinical inertia and how prevalent is it in the United States. And what they found based on the NHANES, which is a National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, looking from 2005 to 2014, is that 50% of people with type 2 had achieved an A1C of less than 7%, which is the ADA's or the American Diabetes Association current recommendation for getting the A1C to an appropriate goal to reduce the preventable microvascular complications that I alluded to earlier. And only 40% of folks with commercial insurance and 30% of people with Medicare, Medicaid are achieving that A1C of less than 7%. And what was very unfortunate was over the 10 years of that study, they did not even notice a difference in how that control actually trended over that 10 years. Unfortunately, clinical inertia is not a problem that is unique to United States patients or providers. Dr. Kamlesh Kunti and his colleagues also saw similar results in their study where they looked across 20 countries. And again, only 30 to 50% of the patients they looked at achieved A1C goals. And in addition to not achieving the A1C or the glycemic targets, people with diabetes, they found that only 20% of patients were also achieving the EASD, which is the European Association Study of Diabetes, which is the counterpart to the American Diabetes Association, and goals for both blood pressure and lipids. And again, they did not see a significant improvement in achievement year by year when they looked at these patients over the course of time. In fact, the average delay for people who are already on basal insulin to intensify treatment is about 4 years, and 60% of those patients had an A1C of at least 9%, and only 30% of them went on to intensify treatment. So it's a significant problem, both here in the United States and around the world. It's important to understand that there's many reasons. It's a multifactorial condition that has contributory factors from both from the patients that have the diabetes, the clinicians that care for them, as well as the healthcare systems with which we are involved in and how we operate. So if we look first at the providers and maybe the systems that the providers find themselves working in, some of the things that can contribute to the clinical inertia is oftentimes providers believe that they themselves, as far as how they're managing their patients, that they're doing okay. They may underestimate the number of patients under their care that are not meeting goals. There's soft excuses that sometimes come into play, allowing the patient to kind of negotiate just 3 more months, kind of conversations that we often find ourselves engaged in. A lack of urgency sometimes, blaming the patient. There is a patient component, of course, but putting more than what would probably be appropriate as far as how much blame for non-adherence would go into that. And there's also a personal bias that we as clinicians bring to the equation of what we think a patient might be willing to do. And so sometimes we don't believe that they would be willing to start insulin or an injectable therapy, and therefore we're hesitant to actually bring it up. In addition to that, there's a system with which we see our patients. And so the time is often a big problem and a barrier. The office visit isn't often long enough. The frequency of allowable or billable follow-up visits, how many ancillary supports people you have in your office that can actually assist you with some of this, technical support, do you have an electronic record, how good is that electronic record with capturing data from blood glucose meters and CGMs and all of that kind of thing. Not to mention training and education, reimbursement, all of that. Then you throw in the guidelines that we currently have available that are supposed to help clinicians figure out how to individualize treatment. And the guidelines themselves are rather confusing. And the guidelines themselves also have a treat to fail approach where, you know, you wait 3 months and if a patient fails this treatment, then that would be when you intensify to the next level. And that contributes to the clinical inertia. Then we, of course, have the patient who comes with their own lack of or misunderstanding of the treatment of diabetes, the actual disease process. How engaged are they, not just in their own self-management, but with the providers who are attempting to help them? Some of the things that they bring to the office as far as their understanding or misunderstanding can be influenced by attitudes of themselves, family members, friends, things that they're seeing or hearing on the media, which contributes perhaps to some of the misperception and fear. We also don't know what their priorities are, what's going on in their life that is preventing them from moving forward with their own management of the diabetes. They don't necessarily feel badly, and sometimes the medications that we prescribe, when they do take them, make them actually feel badly. A lot of patients associate medication with disease and illness, and they are not claiming a disease or illness. It's easier for them sometimes to take supplements because those are associated with wellness rather than disease. And perhaps the patient have set some unrealistic goals. I have had many patients that come to my office and they tell me that they want to come off all of their medications. That's their goal. And, you know, diabetes is not a disease that has a cure. So it's unlikely that patients would be able to come off their meds.